Welcome to the Mindfulness Podcast. This is David Black. My guest today is Dr. Danella Hafman, MD, PhD, Assistant Professor of Psychiatry at the University of Pittsburgh. She is a child psychiatrist and also holds a PhD in epidemiology. Her research focus is on youth at risk for bipolar disorder, and she tests interventions to prevent mood disorders in this group. She studies the brain and the behavioral features of bipolar disorder and its risk. She also performs clinical work as a psychiatrist in the Child and Adolescent Bipolar Services Clinic. Welcome, Dr. Hafman. You were recently awarded an R01, very prestigious award from the National Institutes of Health, in particular, the National Institute of Mental Health. You have a project titled Neurobehavioral Targets of Mindfulness in Youth at Risk for Mood Disorders. So welcome today. And you're focusing in on mood disorders with youth. Why do you think this is an important focus at this point in time? Why youth with mood disorders?
Well, so first, thank you so much for inviting me to be on this podcast. It's a pleasure to be here and talk about our work. So mood disorders are really an important source of morbidity and really suffering in adolescence. And actually, the incidence of mood disorders has been going up even before the pandemic, but especially also recently with the pandemic. And so our focus has really been if we can intervene early in a way to sort of prevent that suffering. And so a lot of our work has been on bipolar disorder and then mood disorders in general, trying to understand really what the early signs are, because a lot of times the early signs can cause suffering too. You know, you don't need to meet full DSM criteria for a major depressive episode to really be struggling. And so if we can identify those signs early and have, you know, ways to intervene, that can really impact trajectories, because, you know, you only get to do middle school and high school once. I mean, these are really important developmental times as well. So you know, if there's a way to sort of boost emotion regulation, boost resilience during those times, it can, you know, affect trajectories, brain development, and hopefully long-term well-being and flourishing. So
you mentioned middle and high school. What is the age range? You also are at the clinic doing clinical work. What's the age range you focus on?
So I'm a child and adolescent psychiatrist, but I do work at a clinic for youth with and at risk for bipolar disorders. So often the onset of bipolar disorder is in adolescence and early adulthood. We do have some kids that are younger as well with mood disorders and family risk. But the range is really from, you know, quite young almost, although most of my kids would be more than 8 and then up until early adulthood. Actually, most of my patients at this point are early adult, like young adults, transitional age. So a lot of like college students or people who are of that age too.
But as young as 8, and looking at your study, I was reading over your study, recent one published in Journal of Affective Disorders. You open with the point on family history, and this was really intriguing to me. Like, how do you see family history of mood disorder, the percent contributing? What is our best estimate to the percent contributing to their child? And then what are the other environmental factors that are really important if we're trying to identify risk and then reduce that risk? There, I'm assuming environment is also playing a role here.
Oh, absolutely. Right. So the answer to that question is actually different for bipolar disorder and major depressive disorder. So bipolar disorder, there is a very strong increase with family history. Family history is the most important predictor for bipolar disorder. Now, that's not to say that environmental factors don't have a play. They definitely do in terms of like early life stress and abuse can increase risk, especially decrease age of onset, so increase risk for earlier onset, along with other factors that have been assessed. But, you know, like environmental factors, there's a little bit less evidence, but it's, you know, definitely possible that there are other sort of exposures in the environment that can have an impact. With major depression, family history does play a role, but it's a lot more also the environmental factors of stress and early life events. But, you know, if we really think about the offspring of individuals with mood disorders, you know, they are at overall higher risk either through genetic or environmental sort of pathways. And so it's an important group to potentially intervene with because of this higher risk and especially if they're already showing symptoms.
What can you remind me, especially because you probably deal with the diagnosis, the seeing a child at eight, you're saying that's more risk oriented and they may not meet full criteria. I can't recall even what the full criteria are. Can you remind me, like in youth, bipolar, like what would be some of the critical criteria, the length of time observing these things? Like how would you do the assessment? And then make the differentiation if it's like a diagnosis versus just a risk, a person who has elevated risk for becoming diagnosed.
Right. Yeah. So it's a great question. So the diagnostic criteria are at this point the same between children and adults for bipolar disorder, adolescents and adults. So you need to have that episodic period of either elevated mood or in some cases irritability along with an increased energy. And so those are kind of like the criterion A, like the first symptoms. And then there's several sort of criterion B symptoms, things like decreased need for sleep, increased goal-directed activity, hyperactivity, grandiosity. So feeling like, you know, you're really awesome, and a few others. So the key though is the if it's episodic and if it's lasting for a substantial amount of time. So it's not just like, oh, you have these symptoms for like 30 minutes, you know, but that it is lasting. For full criteria, it needs to be lasting at least 4 days for hypomania, 7 days for mania. There's a lot of rules, but in terms of the sort of bipolar spectrum, we also consider people who have shorter periods, so like lasting a day or so, with all of those symptoms as having kind of other specified bipolar disorder. So in that case, they're kind of along that spectrum, but not maybe fully meeting criteria for threshold bipolar disorder. But that kind of separates the people who are having like some symptoms, but not the full disorder.
So, and you know, parents listening and myself being a parent might hear some of those symptoms and be like, wait, that's just kind of like my five-year-old's life. So what is it about the diagnosis? Is it that it becomes distressing for the child and parent? What is the problematic piece to that? Because some of those things just kind of seem like there would be a spectrum of that behavior, like hyper goal oriented, tons of energy, wild energy that is not controllable by environmental contingencies. So what's the problematic piece?
Right. So a couple different things. So one, this is like, in terms of differentiating from normal development, it's this sort of spontaneous episodicity. So it's not that the kids like this all the time, but they're becoming like this for like at least a day or so, sometimes longer, and there's no apparent reason. So that's part of it. But yeah, absolutely, there's an impairment of functioning piece. So, you know, are they sort of not able to function in school, right? So if you're really like, have the high energy, you know, elated mood, hyperactivity, then school functioning during that time is not going to be so great. So looking at functional impairment is very important in deciding upon the diagnosis. And it turns out that kids with other specified bipolar disorder have really almost as much impairment as kids with a full bipolar disorder. So this is definitely very separate from sort of like normal development, although all of this stuff is along a continuum, I would say. You know, it's really a question of when it becomes very functionally impairing. And then, of course, with bipolar disorder, really what is most impairing for most people is the depression. And so that is, is very common in those kids who are also having the high moods.
And does this tend to happen? So this is very interesting to me. So if it's on a day basis, there's an unexpected 24-hour period. It just seems like the activities of this child are not the norm of what the child usually behaves within. Mm-hmm. And then what is the time frame where there may be the opposite side of that, like not wanting to engage, and then you just see this complete divergence of that energy into low mood, not wanting to do anything, et cetera. What are the relative time frames for these younger folks?
Yeah. So, I mean, it really does vary. I've had younger kids who will have like a period of a week or two of depression, and sometimes it will be either right before or right after one of the high moods. So it can vary a lot. To have a full threshold, bipolar 2 disorder, you need to have the full 2 weeks. And what we see in kids is a lot of times it's not lasting that long. So they would have more the, sub thresholds, although it can still be just as impairing. The time course varies tremendously.
And that one case you were pointing to, so for the singular diagnosis, you said, was it type B? Is that what you mentioned?
Oh, bipolar 2?
Bipolar 2, sorry. So with that one, you said there's a 2 week interval. So is this a 2 week interval on either side of that spectrum? So either depression or depressed mood for that 2 weeks? Or is it like an exchange of these two poles across a 2 week period?
To have the diagnosis, you need to have a major depressive episode for bipolar 2 disorder. And, all of this stuff is like, it's a little bit arbitrary, these criteria, but because it really is, I think, more along a spectrum. But to have bipolar 2, you need to have a full period of depression, which is really 2 weeks of meeting criteria for major depression. So not just sad mood, but also things like low energy, maybe sleeping more, those sorts of things. And then also on the other pole, have that high mood lasting for at least 4 days. There are no rules about, how much time has to be between them. A lot of people do have a pattern of like they have a high mood and then it drops into a low mood, or the opposite. People will notice that. But there's no rules about like when the timing has to be for the diagnosis.
So in your work, it seems like a centerpiece is mood lability. Am I saying that correctly? Mm-hmm. So it seems to be what you're talking about, like a mood to a variable to degree. And then is there a second piece that's a mood to a variable degree that is like to these high boundaries in both directions, in addition to them having some kind of problem, whether it be distress felt by the person or their ability to function? Am I connecting too many different parts, or is that how the definition works?
Right. Well, so mood lability, I would think of it on a different time course than the sort of down for 4 days or down for 2 weeks, up for 4 days, right? So mood lability is really over the course of the day, how much is mood switching? That's sort of like you never know what mood you're going to get. Are they happy, sad, mad, scared? It's switching a lot and more than what you would expect given the environmental stimuli. And so what we and others have found is that these sort of mood switches, which are really, related to emotion dysregulation, right? So not being able to sort of regulate states kind of in this homeostatic way, right? Instead of there's this like going really high, maybe with a stimulus, maybe not, but then like right down again, that this sort of mood lability is a precursor to mood episodes. And that is bipolar disorder, but also major depression, actually, that it's been found to predict. And then even beyond diagnosis, it predicts things like suicidal thoughts and behaviors, and also substance use, which makes sense, right? Because these are the really, being in that kind of mood state, it's like, well, how do you regulate that? And so that's why it's something that we've been really interested in targeting. So it's different from actually having a mood episode although mood episodes can be associated with a lot of mood lability, but it's separate from that. And so the question is if we can target that mood lability before they've actually had a full-blown mood episode, you know, can we then ultimately, it would be great if we could prevent that, but at least delay it so that it's not, you know, that it's not happening and maybe not as intense or bad.
So these, yeah, the exaggerated changes in mood you point out in some of your earlier work, this is a feature of something we would call transdiagnostic in a way that it's a symptom that kind of crosses over a lot of what we might call mental health ailments or problems or diagnoses because the ability to regulate ourselves given input from the environment, both internal sensory and external cues, that's an important feature of the human capacity, right? To be able to keep stability in the face of all of these things occurring. And given inheritance factors, like you mentioned, that might play a role into some vulnerabilities, early lifestyle exposures. And then looking towards the future, the reason that you point out this is important in your work is it can link or associate or predict some things like suicide risk. We'd all find that to be really important. And as you mentioned, also other types of diagnoses that we would like to prevent in younger people, for sure. So you went forward then. So thanks for educating me on mood disorders and on youth. And I can't always remember these things to their exactness with diagnosis. But since you're finding this group, they're vulnerable, they're younger, and you're trying to figure out ways, like what are behavioral means to help with emotion regulation, you seem to be using a mindfulness-based intervention approach. So where did your interest come from in that approach and how might it work?
Right. So, well, in terms of my interests, I had a longstanding interest in meditation, like a personal interest, although it definitely had waxed and waned over the years. The year before I really got my funding for my initial pilot study for mindfulness intervention, I had been doing training in dialectic behavior therapy as part of my child psychiatry training. And one of the modules of that is mindfulness. So I would not say DBT is not a mindfulness-based intervention, although some people sometimes group it that way, but I would not say it is. But there's a core element of that that is mindfulness. So that was sort of my first experience in teaching mindfulness to adolescents and doing those kinds of mindfulness practices. And so I got funding from the Klingenstein Foundation, which is a great foundation that supports sort of child and adolescent psychiatry research, to explore this further and to develop and then test a mindfulness-based intervention, not a randomized controlled trial, just a straight, you know, bring people in and then start to look at the neural targets as well, because I was very interested in how the mindfulness-based intervention might improve emotion regulation, but also emotion regulation circuitry and circuitry related to that has been found in other studies with mindfulness intervention. So that's kind of how I got started with that. And the pilot study, so I was the teacher during the pilot study. I was trained with a mindfulness in schools project. So a lot of it, we ended up borrowing some of our activities from that. And the structure is really borrowed from MBSR and MBCT. And so it was a very formative experience doing those groups and running that intervention. And it was an iterative approach of developing, you know, what works and what doesn't work with these kids. And then I think, honestly, though, what really brought me forward were the 3-month evaluations with these kids. It was just fun to see. And, you know, I share a lot of the qualitative data when I do presentations on what kids and their parents say. It was just fun to see the changes and how they seemed better. And that doesn't always happen in clinics. So, again, I can't say that it was because of the mindfulness intervention. That's why we need to do the randomized controlled trial. But it sure was enticing So, and then we found some very interesting brain changes that were similar to what had been found in adult studies, and we could talk more about those as well. And so, you know, it really lent itself to asking for money to do a bigger study and really testing sort of what is about mindfulness versus non-specific aspects of the groups, and how is this, what are the neural and behavioral targets that might mediate these changes.
And this was your youth group, 10 to 14 years old, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I'm interested in that point you made about the experiences. So the verbal feedback and observation made since you're in the class with them. So 10 to 14 year olds, what were some key observations for you when they participate in a mindfulness program? Again, we're asking young people to meditate to a degree, doing different forms, whether it be scanning their bodies with an open awareness or focused attention, or whether it be cultivating positive emotions or just attending to the breath. What did you observe there in 10 to 14 year olds?
So I would say that it was different from group to group. Group dynamics varied tremendously. And also I want to sort of give the context that most of these kids actually met criteria for some DSM psychiatric disorder. So a lot of them were already in treatment for things like ADHD and anxiety, some for oppositional behaviors. So it was not, it was at times a challenging group to run. But a few observations from that. One, when the kids did the practices, there was, it's really incredible to see going from a ton of energy to the stillness. And so, right, there were a couple of times doing that, that was just very like marked and noticeable. The other thing, though, we did realize that, you know, if the social pressures and the social stimuli are profound for these kids, so, you know, there's a lot of motivation to be the clown who is talking during the mindfulness practice. So we actually did, we had a reward system, a behavioral incentive system for staying quiet during the practice. And actually, if they stayed quiet, they got one bean buck. If everybody stayed quiet, they got two bean bucks. So that kind of reversed the social pressure, so that people were like, don't mess up my bean bucks. And then they got to trade them in for candy. So this really allowed for the very focused practice without sort of like somebody, you know, talking. And then the really wonderful thing about the mindfulness intervention is that after that, there can be this complete like non-judgment, like, oh, that stunk. Okay, tell me more. Wow, that sounds like a judgment. What was the sensation like? Like, there's a lot of ways for dealing with that once you've had that period of silence. And so I think that combination of sort of strategies, like behaviorally rewarding the silence, and then really that being with whatever is in the room after that with an attitude of non-judgment, right? Really kind of shaped the group dynamics. So I think that was a really interesting experience. I mean, I think middle school is it's a challenging time to be a teacher of any sort, you know, for a number of reasons. And it's a time of a huge amount of brain development. So, you know, circuitry for emotion regulation, executive function, that's all really coming online during that time. So you can see tremendous changes. And so the idea of doing an intervention then is that if you're able to sort of shift a trajectory, maybe that really has a more lasting effect on development. We don't know for sure, but that's been at least the hypothesis of some other people who do sort of developmentally based interventions.
Those adaptations seem really important, I can imagine. And I believe in some of the classes I have observed, yeah, the amount of interruptions are ever present. And some of the ways also I've seen are like, if you can get them to move physically, like some light yoga or laying on back so they can't see what others are doing, there's all kinds of ways in which this has to be adapted, but your incentive approach seems meaningful to getting everyone to pay attention. That's a real challenge. What would you say? So in terms of mood lability, I keep thinking about this term because as we develop and our brains are changing towards greater self-regulation to a degree at the cognitive level and at the emotional level, outside of a program, because I'm trying to link up what a mindfulness-based intervention would do, would it speed up that capacity? Whereas what would be the naturalistic environment that people would learn these similar skills? I'm trying to like figure out what we're trying to do here so we could speed up that path, because usually in school and stuff, students learn, take your turn and do this assignment that will teach you to sit still, or here's an incentive. And those small pieces added together may structure a self-regulatory capacity over time. Do you see what I mean? And like maybe take that to a more clear example of where we're trying to go with this.
Yeah, I mean, I would not look at it as a speeding up. I think actually, that it actually comes to mind that kids who have undergone a lot of trauma, actually they have quicker brain development. You know, they look like they're older than they are. And you know, speeding up is not always a good thing. I think that this is actually qualitatively different because it brings on board that sort of non-judgmental self-awareness and meta-awareness of what is in the moment. So I think a lot of those emotion regulation strategies that kids learn at school and sometimes at home, they're very rule-based, right? So like you do this, you don't do this. It's not so much about like, you know, really becoming aware of what the emotional state is. It's not about becoming aware of what your, you know, where your body is in space and how you're sitting in the chair right now. Like there's not that aspect of it. I mean, so there are social emotional learning programs now that are trying to integrate that, but I don't think sort of traditionally it's about, you know, you need to follow the rules and this is what you do, right? And so I think mindfulness brings online other sort of capacities. And so, you know, the way I think about how it might relate to emotion regulation is kind of twofold. So one, when you're then aware of what's going on in your body, in your mind, your emotional, then you can sort of make more of a choice to respond versus react. So I think that's a big part of this. I mean, I think a lot of the kids in the program, they're having these mood swings and they can't necessarily just follow the rules a lot of times, right? And so this is a way of really then giving that space to make a choice as opposed to just that reaction. And then the other thing is like bringing back to the present so that there's not all of the mind wandering and catastrophizing. I mean, mind wandering can be a wonderful thing, but catastrophizing and really getting sucked up into your mind stories where then you're reacting to something that is not at all in the room and having these big reactions. And, you know, that can cause a lot of suffering and then also leads you to break rules, right? So I think that it's a sort of maybe a backdoor way of sort of, you know, ultimately maybe having that better emotion regulation that, you know, school and development like just would teach, right? But that it is through developing these capacities of self-awareness that these kids can do it sort of in a different way.
Yeah, and you put something straightforward in your writing about unintentional mind wandering. So unintentional mind wandering, if your mind is just free without observation of what the mind is doing, if no one ever learns that, you suggest that this amplifies negative affect. Does it always kind of tend in that direction? A wandering mind tends towards negative affect?
So there's actually conflicting data on this. One of the initial studies really showed that, and other people haven't always shown that. I think it's more, you know, I think there are certain people that are vulnerable to that, and maybe it's not just negative. I mean, I think sometimes the positive can spiral too, right? And it's about, I think it's about the relationship to the mind wandering, you know, like don't believe everything you think. Like, it's such a, you know, simple phrase, but I think that captures a lot of it. If you look at the mind wandering as just something that the mind does, you know, that is one thing. If you're believing everything that that the mind tells you, that's going to lead to stronger emotional responses. It may lead to sort of more reactivity. So yeah, that changing that relationship. There's also a decentering aspect to that, right? So like the mind, all these stories not being the center of everything, like being able to see yourself as separate from the stories that your mind is telling.
And then you study brain activity linked with this process, linked with mindfulness practice, and perhaps mood lability. Are you in this project and be doing some brain activity assessment? And why is that? What are we looking at for this group of young folks? I mean, that's hard enough that you're doing assessments on young folks, and, you know, doing brain scans with this group is challenging with parents involved and kids being uncomfortable, but that's amazing that you're able to do it. And then what are you focusing in on? What's relevant for brain activity?
Right. So the answer is there are probably many things that are relevant, but what we are focusing on is really this, this marker that we observed in our pilot data and has also been observed by several others. So I'll tell you what the marker is, and then I'll let you know who else has kind of found that. But it's an increased functional connectivity between posterior cingulate and dorsolateral prefrontal cortex. So I'll break that down. Posterior cingulate is really like the seat of the default mode network. And the default mode network is basically what lights up in the MRI when you are not doing anything. And then when you're doing a task, it's kind of like inhibited. And what it's really involved in, well, it's involved in a lot of things, but one of the things is mind wandering. Another is self-related processing. And so, you know, when the mind's telling stories about the past and the future, the posterior cingulate is probably very, very important to that, especially when it's related to self, right? So like, I'm going to totally mess this up or whatever the story is, right? Like that's default mode, time travel type thing. Dorsolateral prefrontal cortex is much more involved in planning. It's involved in this sort of meta awareness, problem solving, these sorts of things. So it's brought online in more executive function tasks. And so the idea is that when with mindfulness, there's sort of more connectivity between these. And the way we measure this is indirect. It's through how much sort of blood oxygen levels are fluctuating together. And it turns out that they fluctuate together in networks that tend to act together. So what we're seeing then is that this is becoming more a part of the same network, or at least firing more often together. And so Judson Brewer first saw this with meditators versus non-meditators. And then since then, there have been several studies that have found this in adults following mindfulness intervention. So David Creswell had one of the first studies, Tony King, David Fresco has some similar data. And what's interesting about all of these studies, and then we found the same in youth. What's interesting about all these studies is it's not just that increased functional connectivity. It's also that increased functional connectivity predicts who does better. So those who increase that connectivity the most, at least in our study, had been more of a decrease in mood lability and anxiety, actually, and an increase in mindfulness. And in other studies, it's been sort of other outcomes, depending on, you know, what the primary outcome is of the study. So that's why we were really interested in looking at that and looking at the changes over the time course. So we're actually scanning people right before the intervention, halfway through the intervention, at the end, and then 3 months after. And so the idea is to see, you know, when is that increase happening, assuming that we do see an increase, which, you know, if we don't, then oh well, but we predict that we will. And then how is that related to measures of mind wandering and sustained attention, which we're getting through tasks, and then through something called ecological momentary assessment, which is basically asking the kids a bunch of times on the phone to read. And then how is that related then to mood lability? So, you know, what we're hypothesizing is that this, increased circuitry will be very related to mind wandering, and then all of that will predict mood lability. It may be the opposite. We may see that, you know, mood lability decreases first and then these things increase, you know, so we don't know for sure. But the design will allow us to look at that, and then also to look at this in the control group that's not getting any mindfulness, and see sort of that this is, if this is unique to mindfulness versus, you know, other sort of like a health enhancement group.
And your use of tasks is really important. That's kind of what the field continues to need, strong objective behavioral assessment to the best of our abilities. You will have these neural, which to me, and tell me if I'm incorrect, like patterns that represent biomarkers for the behavioral changes that are occurring. We're suggesting that they are confirmations of the behavioral change. Are we suggesting that, or?
I think it may be more of alternate ways of looking at it, right? So, you know, it's like the elephant, there's the trunk and the tail. And so different levels of assessment. So task, MRI, self-report, all give sort of different aspects. They're not always tightly correlated, but different aspects of the same sort of construct that we're fundamentally interested in. But all of those things are imperfect ways of getting at it. So the idea of sort of doing this kind of multimodal assessment is to, yes, start to understand the degree to which, you know, improvement in the sustained attention to response task, or SART, that's our measure of sustained attention, to the degree that that sort of tracks with the neural changes, right? So this is what we would predict, but it's not, it's more than one validating the other, or it's more about like looking at things from different perspectives and understanding too what the neural markers may be reflecting, what constructs are they reflecting.
So I'm really interested. Remind me about the SART. So we have, these are 11 to 13 year olds. And I'm sorry to be specific here, but this is just really interesting to me because it's like the task we are asking them to do. And we assume there's improvement. It's like a key behavioral task that's beyond self-report. Because typically we know any students or youth that are going to go through a program and have all of these forces working on them, like adults in the room and trying to get them better, will always report that they're typically better. We know this from all of science, but in the behavioral sciences, we really try to get to these measures. So that's why I'm attracted to the sustained attention SART measure. What, for people that don't know it, and I can't remember it at this point, what are we asking youth to do? Because this is really interesting. It might teach us something about what happens after they are part of a mindfulness program.
Right. So I think one thing that's key about the SART is it's actually pretty boring. So you're asked to pay attention during something that does not necessarily hold your attention naturally, right? And so really the main test of this is how well do you voluntarily sustain attention, right? The actual task, what they're doing, they're shown a series of numbers and they have to press the button for every number except for the number 3. So it sounds very simple, but the numbers come, they come fairly quickly. And you know, if your mind goes somewhere else and you are thinking about dinner, then maybe you're responding to the 3 even when you're not supposed to. That's the most common error, is that you accidentally respond because most of the stimuli require a response. Another thing that we do, which others have done this too, like Amishi Jha has used this. So we have a probe of mind wandering, like, you know, where was your mind just now type thing? Was it on the task versus not? They rate it on a scale. And then how aware were you? Because, you know, sometimes we might choose to think about something else because we're sick of thinking about whatever we're doing. So we're really trying to get at the construct of the times when the mind was wandering, but that there wasn't necessarily awareness of that. And so that is sort of, that's self-report in a way, but it is also, you know, done in the context of that task. And then we'll also have data about both accuracy, but also response times. So there's ways of modeling response times to look at sort of how regular the responses to the non-3 stimuli are. And that's a sign that, you know, there's sort of good attention. So you can model that and look at how much variability there is in the response time.
So these behavioral measures are really important because you're asking them to perform on a task, to do certain, follow certain instructions. They've just gone through a course where they've sustained attention during an instructional task. And in doing so, I don't know the emotional, there's no emotional piece to this, right? That would kind of tap into the, so this is the attentional element. So it might show something about behaviorally, can they sustain attention and detect divergence? That's kind of an interesting piece. The same way in practice, they were detecting moments of thoughts arising, emotions arising, but without reactivity. So that's actually kind of an interesting task that you're saying it to me, because we're asking them to react to the coming up of an environmental stimulus. So maybe a generalized attentional capacity here we're talking about. The EMA, for people who don't know this, ecological momentary assessment, you're following these people, young people, for 9 months, if I'm remembering this correctly. Mm-hmm. So for those who don't know this procedure, why use that kind of protocol?
Right. So, you know, traditional self-reports, which is what our initial study was based on and what a lot of studies are based on, you know, they ask you about some time period in the last 2 months, 2 weeks. A lot of times people don't read that question. I mean, I can't tell you how many times, like, people have said something that you know, did not happen in the last 2 weeks. It was months ago. But anyway, that aside, you're still asking people to really, like, you know, rate how they've been feeling for this long period of time, which, you know, half the time it's hard to remember what I had for dinner last night, right? Like, it's not so easy to rate, like, overall emotional state, or I think it captures a lot more of maybe how you're feeling at the moment instead of that sort of, you know, integrative thing that you would prefer. So what EMA does is it really, it asks simple questions. So for us, we're just asking about 8 emotions, 4 positive, 4 negative. How have you been feeling in the last 15 minutes? And they do that prompt, and also a prompt about mind wandering that I talked about before. But they do that 3 times on weekdays. So once before school, 2 times after school, and then actually 6 times on weekends. And so they do that for a total of 6 days. So 4 weekdays, 2 weekend days. And so what it does is it gives you like a sort of temporal roadmap of where their emotions are. You know, are they always kind of in this like slightly positive state, or, you know, are they really negative 1 minute and then super positive the next? Like, is there a ton of variability? And so you can actually start to model that variability by looking at how much it's changing from time point to time point, and model things like the inertia of the emotion versus the variability of the emotions, and get at different aspects of mood lability that, you know, may better capture the construct that we're interested in than like a global questionnaire.
So that's great. So it reduces that recall. You have to imagine these are young folks, and asking them to think back to the past month is a lot to ask them to do. This tries to avoid some of that. You can ask them in real time how they are, and perhaps at random times, so you don't like only get certain points of the day, say at night. Very interesting to be able to capture good responses of self-report, and you also have behavioral assessment. One more question I have for you is the adherence piece. So I'm currently trying to look closely at a trial that I ran and really try to see what people are doing behaviorally with the uptake of practice. It is probably the most important piece, like what behaviorally the person does. Do they sit down, do the meditation practice outside of the class? This probably differs with adults. So in talking with others running MBSR programs, we know that some people are willing to go 45 minutes in a single day, every day. That's really amazing. What are you suggesting for these younger folks, 11 to 13 years old? Is there an adherence that they're expected to meet with practice outside on a daily basis or on a weekly basis?
Right. So there definitely with the structure of the program, there is home practice. It would not be 45 minutes. It would be, we would love if they would do like 5 to 10 minutes a day. It is a challenge with this age group. One thing I will say that we do, so we give them things to hopefully sort of make them think about practice. So for instance, one of the like main practices that we have is the Dot B from the Mindfulness in Schools project. It's a practice that you can do anywhere, but you can also sort of like elongate it into really a meditation. So we make stickers of the Dot B, and then they can put them in their math binders or their lockers. So really, that's just an example of like kind of emphasizing mindfulness in daily life. So that it's, you know, if they can sit down and practice, that's great. And for these, I had made a, you know, a recording of the Dot B that some of the kids listened to, but it was not, you know, it's not as much as we would like. But just to have this way of integrating with their day between sessions, I think is like the perhaps the most important thing, you know, that they are able to sort of bring mindfulness to mind when something like that can be helpful. I would love it if they were practiced every evening.
Yeah, adherence is hard across the board. Absolutely. But there's also perhaps something to be said just for young people getting the taste for the possibility of being aware of thoughts and emotions that they don't have to react to. Like, that's hard enough. And that continues into adulthood. But just so they have a flavor for it is also important. So I usually focus a lot on behavioral adherence, but also realize that sometimes just being exposed to this being one of the ingredients of the human experience comes in later into play when people realize, oh, wait, I don't have to react. I do realize that there's a decentering. So that's also super important. Any final notes about your future work? You know, there's already a big plan ahead. You got years to go. Maybe what are you most excited about this project?
Yeah, well, I'm really excited to be able to see which of the effects of mindfulness are specific. So I know, you know, running the groups, I know how powerful just being in the groups were, like just the kids fundamentally realizing that they're not alone in what they're experiencing, right? So there is that sort of aspect of social support that comes with mindfulness groups. And so I'm very interested to look at sort of how that without the mindfulness compares to that with the mindfulness. And then this marker, the neural marker that I talked about, the posterior cingulate DLPFC, I think, you know, that I'm very interested in exploring that further. I mean, obviously I'll be doing that with this study. I think thinking about collaborative studies with others to really start to tease apart, like, what is going on with that? And then finally, I'm also exploring a neurofeedback through fMRI to try to increase that functional connectivity as well. So that is a project that we are currently still trying to get off the ground. We've run, you know, several participants, but that is also in the future. So.
Wonderful talking with you today, Dr. Hafman. Thank you for your time and good luck on your project.
Thank you so much. It's been fun.
Our recordings are at goamra.org. That's it for today. Bye now.